I am so glad that we now have Dr. Tuana Sparks is in the studio with us. We were worried about you, Tuana.
I deeply apologize for being late today.
But we're just glad you're here.
Unforeseen circumstances. But if you'd rather I come another day, you're doing a great job today.
Thanks for coming in.
You joined at a great time because the question I had posed, Mary, because you're both healthcare practitioners.
Right.
And how one makes the journey inside oneself from saving a life to advocating for its right to end. The training.
Hold on to that thought. That's a wonderful question. I like where you're going with this, Scott.
Okay.
But I want to introduce our guest, Dr. Tuana Sparks. She is a physician who grew up in Grant County, New Mexico. Although she's retired, she was an ear, nose, and throat surgeon. Tuana is continuing her practice in medicine by assisting people in dying with dignity and comfort, and has become one of the foremost providers of medical aid in dying in the state of New Mexico, where this is legal. She tries to support her community in any way possible, opening a homeless shelter in 2019, tutoring for Literacy Link, and volunteering with the Fort Baird Fire Department. She also wrote a book, Passing Stories of Medical Aid in Dying, and a book I haven't had a chance to read yet, Ping Pong Balls and Donkey's Milk, A History of Tuberculosis in the Fort Baird, New Mexico. I have. But what other thing I want to mention is your vibrant energy and what a supportive mentor you are to our community,
particularly
those of us who are working in this End of Life Options New Mexico. That's a volunteer group. We don't represent them right now as we're talking. You know, we're not representing them, but there is a group that meets monthly, and we are supporting one another and supporting the community. And I really appreciate the leadership and the mentoring you have provided for us, Tuana.
Thank you for saying that.
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, that is an introduction to Dr. Tuana Sparks.
That's a proper introduction, I would
say.
Yeah,
I will tell you that, and you wear so many hats, I bet there's a lot of people who will recognize your name.
And there are many people in this community who knew me when I was a scrawny little, you know, snotty-nosed kid, and they know all my flaws and strengths. So the introduction is probably not necessary for 90%.
Well,
yeah.
It's nice to know. I think Tuana let me know that my husband's family's from this community, Cyril Nalty, and Tuana, way back when she was a small child, sat a few rows back from my husband's grandmother. So
that's right.
I think it was Hurley. What people don't know is that Tuana will get in her car, and if someone's dying and qualifies for medical assistance in dying, will get in her car and drive often into the night, halfway across southern New Mexico, to help a patient administer their own concoction. I have been privileged to work with her in a few different capacities. Tuana undertakes the process with such reverence, and she has a shrine she's created in her own home for every single person she's helped cross. There's a photo of hands, there's a candle, there's a remembrance. So it's sacred time, which is what I'm getting from you. And so my question, which I should have waited for the bio and the introduction to ask.
We forgive you.
Okay, thanks. is how does one...
And in the past, that has not been a focus. I have pretty good pain pills. I have IV morphines. I have counselors to come in and play music or give massage or do, you know, spiritual counseling, that sort of relief. But to actually let someone relieve their pain by dying is a horrifying concept to begin with. And then it becomes more of a blessing to be able to participate in that, help them with as much relief as I can during life, and then it's just a natural transition to help them relieve their pain as much as I can in their death. And for many people, that's a spiritual transition that they can't make. The Buddhists say every minute is for teaching. So some of the Buddhist people who have talked to me said, well, I can never do that because I don't know what I have yet to learn. And for me, I don't have any problem with thinking that suffering has no merit. What are you going to learn in the next 6 months that you can't learn in the next 6 weeks or the next 6 days from being horribly short of breath, from being horribly in pain, from being totally disabled from a paralyzing disease where you have zero quality of life? So I don't have that barrier for, well, there's something here to learn. I also don't have the barrier anymore of, well, if I help this person take their life or if they take their own life, then they're going to have to answer to their creator. I was raised in a very specific black and white thinking on that, and it took me probably 20 years to get past that. If I am suffering, and then I'm not obligated to my constructed God or my belief in God, that I have to keep on suffering because it would be wrong to stop. And I think that's the biggest problem for most people who cannot participate in this, either as patients or as physicians or nurse practitioners or physician assistants, that maybe we're doing something wrong by letting people take control of their destiny. And oftentimes family members become involved in the decision making. And when I call someone and say, you've been referred to me, I understand you want to learn about end of life options, I'll come to your home in the next 24 hours. I'll tell you what I have to offer. And if you have a family or a friend member who would be absolutely opposed to this, I'm going to ask you not to have them there, and not that you don't have to involve them if you want to. You don't have to involve anybody but me and you and the hospice nurse and the funeral director to come and get your body. When they see my name on the death certificate, they're going to know that that's the only kind of medicine I do. But I say, if you ask people who are opposed or who are judging you for this decision, we have to deal with their emotions. We have to deal with their problem, and we don't get to focus on you who are trying to make the hardest decision of your whole life. So I've learned an enormous amount about how much suffering impacts people. If I get a toothache, you know, I go to bed for a week. So I should have had more compassion and empathy in my lifetime for people who I've cut on their, it's usually head and neck cancer. I've radiated them. We've poisoned them with chemo. They can't eat. They can't talk. People have stopped coming to visit. And I feel like I have done my job because that's all I had to offer. So it's fantastic that now if someone has gone through that or said, I'm not doing all that stuff for 3 or 4 more months of poor quality life and pain, I can say, here's an option you have that is going to be nothing but a treatment to stop your pain. And that's the way the states have come to look at it, who write the laws. And I've used this example a lot. We quit saying assisted suicide because there's technically nothing suicidal about somebody taking a medication and passing away. And that's a huge leap for legislators and doctors and patients to make. If a person's suicidal, they could live, but they've decided that there's something intolerable about it, and so they've chosen to die. They could tomorrow wake up and say, well, I'll just live. I'll try to be happy. I'll go on another 20 years with my work. I'll try to be with my family 30 or 40 years. They could have that option. I've never helped a suicidal person to pass away. When I see them, they wish they could live. They are actively dying, and I'm doing nothing more than letting them decide, am I going to suffer and die for 6 days, for 6 weeks, for 6 more minutes? And I ask them, Are you suicidal? Do you want to die? Absolutely not. I would love to be alive for as much longer as possible. But I'm not living. There's no quality to this, and I can't think about anything but my pain or my shortness of breath. So please relieve me of this. And it's very insightful that the way the law is written, we don't write down ingested toxic medication as cause of death, because that's considered a treatment for their suffering. Mm-hmm. We write down that they died of their cancer that caused them to need this kind of desperate, extreme relief.
I love what something you said is fascinating to me. The transition you made as a physician to help people love themselves enough to take care of themselves. And I've seen the altar in the house with hands, and there feels like a lot of love in that room. So my question, I guess, is, do you feel like helping someone die, choose this difficult decision, is kind of an act of self-love?
I never thought of it in those terms, Scott, but it's kind of the ultimate act of self-love, to give up the familiar and the love that you know to jump into the unknown, which may be nothing or which may be fantastic the second you get there, and you will have forgotten all of this misery and all these people. I was kind of amazed as I got deeper into medicine that I don't think people very often need doctors. Because what I told people most of my life, quit smoking, exercise more, eat right, quit drinking, you know. And those are things that have nothing to do with the health of the body, have to do with the health of the mind, that I've always felt like if people were raised to be cherishing their own bodies, then I wouldn't be treating most of these human-induced ailments. And the actual illnesses that affect human beings are fairly small in number. Mm-hmm. We're dying of our lifestyle. We're dying of lack of self-care. Mm-hmm. And so absolutely, when it comes time to pass away and you're able to say, I'm going to love myself enough to let go, it's a little bit late if they have caused their own illness, but that's not for me to judge. It's for me to help them with what would make the last day or minutes or months of their life tolerable as a feeling, thinking human being.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense to me, I think, because one demonstration of love is I don't want you to hurt. I can't stop you from hurting, but I'll do what I can to share the burden. And it feels to me, I've never been with you at the moment of a patient transitioning, but it feels to me like a very high level of care. Not to say that the care that physicians provide to relieve suffering that doesn't have to do with death isn't a high level of care, but there's something extra that happens there that is powerful and mysterious and consensual and I think ultimately really necessary. But what I can't get away from is the love. I've heard you speak about it. I've heard your passion, you know, for the patient's rights. I've seen the photographs, as I said, hands being held, and I feel as though if there's anything to imagine about what happens next, it helps me to think that it could and probably does involve love. You know, Mary and I were talking about this a little bit earlier with her grandfather. So for those of us who are afraid, maybe to think about this, even entertain this notion, just imagining a conversation you're having with someone who's considering this and encouraging them to keep naysayers away so that you can entertain this free of judgment and keep that channel open and clear and pure feels like the seed being planted for making what's possible possible. And it feels like it can't happen without love, you know. And as a professional, you have a professional obligation to render a service in a professional way, but it feels to me that at this stage of the game, this becomes a necessary ingredient in the medicine.
That's a really profound way to look at it, Scott, and I look at it more as a convenience. I don't want somebody hassling me while I'm trying to help this person pass. Yes, I need the person to feel the warmth and the allowing of them to make these decisions as they want to. And it's interesting, they take an anti-nausea pill and a pill to empty their stomach so that when they drink this nasty medicine, it's five ordinary medications, but in enormous doses, and it tastes absolutely terrible. So they take this medication, and then they have 30 minutes to wait to make sure the stomach is okay. And I tell them, this is the last 30 minutes of your life, and I'm a stranger to you. I've known you maybe a week, although some people I've known all of our lives, but for the most part, I don't know you. You don't me. I'm involved in this very intimate action of yours, and I will do what you tell me to. I'll step out of the room. We'll turn music. I'll do a one-act play. I'm a pretty good stand-up comic, and I'm trying to tell people this is...
You can have your dog. You can have your cat.
Yes.
You can have your loved ones holding
right.
you,
Absolutely.
Embracing you, cuddling up.
And this is a unique
up.
Time. I've noticed that this is the most present anyone ever may be in their life. The past means nothing. That's never going to be resolved, what hasn't been.
The future's totally unknown.
It doesn't exist. And for those 30 minutes, some people tell me their stories. Some people say, go away. I need time alone. I think the first fellow, I've told his story many times, and in the book In Passing, he's my first patient that I discuss. He said, do you know any jokes? And I said, well, you're lucky, you know. I love jokes. I remember every joke I've ever heard. He said, would you tell me jokes for 30 minutes? And I said, do you care if they're off color or about death? And he said, all the better. So we told each other jokes for 30 minutes. It was so astounding. It was the freest I've ever felt. I was exchanging with a person. I said, and right before he passed, I said, all right, it's time to take the medication. And can you tell me about the jokes, why you did that? He said, I've always dreamed that I could die laughing. Mm. And that was just wonderful to me. I've thought that many times in my life. I want to die laughing. Well, I guess I better laugh every day, all day, because I never know when it's going to hit. But there's an enormous amount of love that comes from families when they're with the person who's passing away and they know there's only 30 minutes left. They say and do things that maybe they've never done in their lives. Adult sons hold their father's hand. They kiss their father. They embrace their mother. They lie down on the bed and hold them. It's just there's no rules for this time except let the person feel the warmth and the love. And I have everybody in the room, if they're willing, to surround the bed and find a bare place on the person's skin, pull up a pajama leg or a sleeve or on their face or their head. Just put our hands on them. And I ask them if they're comfortable to do that. I said, give this person all the love and the warmth that you can send through your hands to let them know they are going out of this world with gratitude for their existence. And I try to say what little thing I know about them. Thank you for all the food you cooked. Thank you for, you know, being a good attorney and trying to fight for justice. Thank you for building sidewalks. Whatever they did, acknowledge that they had impact on the planet. And that's so that they can feel loved and appreciated, even by a stranger. So, yeah, that's a good point. It's a time for the most love. And when I say, you know, it's time to drink the medicine, and then you'll be awake about 2 minutes. And if you have famous last words, you know, you're welcome to say them then. And the most common words are, other than this tastes horrible, or some other expletive that should be deleted. They tell everybody in the room how much they love them, and the people give that back to them.
I think it's a wonderful... I love the detail. I love the... Because it rings true to me. Because I think, in a sense, we think of love as a feeling, but love is what you do.
It is what you do.
And you're doing something for someone, helping someone accomplish something really difficult. And you talk about a stranger. I think what we show people we know the least often is the purest, in a sense, manifestation of that thing we call love. You know, it's like...
That's a good point.
It is,
because we have no history with them, nothing to be a barrier about the way we feel or, you know, past traumas or anything at all. We just have, you're a human being and I'm trying to exercise kindness towards you and hope you do toward me.
And I think, you know, you mentioned In Passing a little while ago, which is a book that's available online and in local bookstores. I ordered a copy myself and it's just going to be getting here. It got here a little slower than I thought it was going to be. But I look at that as an act of love. I'm going to remember these people. I'm going to put these people's stories in this compendium of experience so that they're seen You know, I understand you have to keep names confidential and all those, but I think it's important that the spirit of what happened is witnessed and remembered in that sense. Was that what drove you to create this or write this?
Yes, I thought it would help families and patients who were considering it. Here's mm-hmm. what you're looking at. I thought it would help medical students and doctors who were asking for some kind of text because it's now legal in New Mexico, but we really weren't prepared to teach this in medical school. The students were going, well, I'm going to go out there and be asked to do this. What can you tell me about it? So, yes, from a lot of perspectives, I wanted people to know what they were anticipating and to know how to do this in a way that worked well. Mm-hmm. So that was the motivation for the book. And I think allowing people to tell their stories, whether about death or anything else, is very empowering. Mm-hmm. Somebody's looking at you, listening to you. Nobody gets to offer a rebuttal. You just tell your story, and I just hear your story. So mm-hmm. I like to think that, well, I'm in a very unique and privileged position. I can give people that empowering moment near their death, and I can bring them relief in this medicine that I'm privileged to be able to write a prescription for. Mm-hmm. So I feel enormously powerful, but not as an ego trip, but able to do more for humanity mm-hmm. in this stage of my life than ever I have been able to do in the past. So mm-hmm. it's a pinnacle for me. I am really trying to learn the most that I can out of that.
I think it's a wonderful testament to the work that's happened. I mean, if you could speak to someone who might be listening today, who is afraid about making this decision and who may qualify, and, you know, hearing it from someone who has been at the bedside, what would you tell them about how to manage their fear?
Karen DeGenevieve, a nurse practitioner who has run the cancer center off and on for many years and is now learning how to do medical aid in dying, she talks to patients in terms of when they get a cancer diagnosis, oh no, how horrible is this death going to be, and do I have to face it, and can I avoid it? And she asks them to think of, are there things that would be worse to you than death? Hmm. And my gut reaction, my knee jerk is, well, of course not. You're saying goodbye to everything. But the thing that people come up with most often is alienation from their families. Hmm. What if their spouse walked away, or what if their child died, or if they lost people from their lives, they would rather die than have to go through that experience.
Makes so much sense.
So I do that one thing when I talk to people who are very afraid. You know, I think you may have gone through something already that's worse than this experience is going to be. But people who are very indoctrinated with having something fearful and painful happen to them after they've passed, I don't have very much to offer except ask them to reconsider, mm-hmm. you know, if you believe in a loving God, would they insist that you go through this horror while you're being alive?
Yeah.
And are you really hurting anyone by going away, or are you helping them to get over seeing you in pain, to get over the enormous expense, whatever it is? I try to put it in perspective. But since I don't know what's out there and they mm-hmm. don't know what's out there, being afraid is probably a pretty normal reaction. I tell them about people who I have helped in other circumstances who've passed away and come back. And no one has been afraid. No one has seen anything horrific. No one is, the people are now at peace with their passing because they had a good experience. And I reassure the people. I said, I don't know what happens, how long you last, but I know there's something separate from your body, because many people tell stories of, I was up above looking down, I was dead, I was flatlined, I hadn't breathed, I was blue, but I heard everything you said and did. Mm. So I said, I don't know if that lasts for 5 minutes or 5 millennia or whatever, but I know there's something extra. And rest assured that we will not be talking any smack about you until a few hours have passed, just in case you're up at the ceiling.
I'm saving my best jokes for later.
And that, I don't know if that's reassuring or just respectful, but people always talk about, I was up in the corner of the room. I said, we're going to assume you're up in the corner of the room until the mortician comes and carries you away. So we'll be talking good stuff about you. And we hope that you feel the love even when you're gone.
Okay, what's lovely about this to me, is I think very often people who have come to accept the fact that they're dying somehow equate that with the narrative of, well, I've given up. It's a negative thing. But what I'm getting from this conversation is there's so much to be celebrated at that particular moment. And what you're taking care with your patients to remember is I honor what you've done. And everybody here in this room with their hands on your skin honors and loves what you are and what you've done. So I think, in a sense, death is the most wonderful accomplishment, in a sense, you can imagine. When you approach it with that spirit, I feel so much of our narrative in the West is about, oh, I couldn't do anything else, so, you know, I just gave up. And it feels like a downer in so many ways. But I feel like what you're bringing to this conversation is the accomplishment that someone really needs to be recognized for.
But I should explain, at that moment when there are two or three people's hands on the person, that's when I take out my phone and take a quick picture. There's nothing identifying about it, not the person's face, usually not even their clothes enough to know. And that's what I put in their little apple juice jar that I've mixed their poison in. I'm sorry, their medication. And that's what I put on my altar. And I send a copy of that to the family. And I've never had anything but gratitude. Thank you for letting us remember this last moment when the person was talking still and not after they were gone.
It's a gift. I've always felt it was a gift to be present when somebody passes. Death is a precious moment.
And I'd like to say one more thing. I just read in a novel, which is mostly what I do in my spare time, is read novels. Someone is dying, and the person speaking says there are many harsh realities to face about dying. And that's probably why most of us don't talk about it. But when you start to think or talk about it, there's just the possibility that it will enhance your enjoyment of what you are doing now and be able to look at the joy of your life in even a clearer perspective, because you know those things are coming. And let people help you through the harsh realities instead of pretending like it doesn't exist and not wanting to speak about it.
So glad you were able to make it. And we were worried. We thought something had happened, but I'm glad that you are alive and well and continuing to do what you do.
Yes, indeed. And thank you, Dr. Tuana Sparks and Scott Plate. Thanks for being with me here. We're beyond the border here.
Uh-huh.
We are, and we will be back beyond the border. This amazing discussion about death and dying and all the amazing, mysterious, wonderful pieces of it will continue the fourth Tuesday of every month, KURU. 89.1 FM and GMCR.org on the World Wide Web, Gila Members Community Radio in Silver City, New Mexico. Thank you for tuning in to Tuesday Morning Beat. Take care, be well, be kind, and don't succumb to the chaos.